for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. My name is Anna.
And I'm Sam.
We are on my lucky number of Andor Season 1. We're on episode 11 of 12.
Daughter of Ferrix. Woo-hoo! We are rapidly approaching the end of Andor.
Oh, man.
Do we have any updates before we begin?
We do. We are so excited that we are going to be appearing on the FSF Popcasts Friday at 5 this Friday, where we ranked the top 5 jobs in Star Wars and just laughed our little heinies off.
So check them out there. I believe it's on YouTube and wherever you get your FSF podcast. They've been a friend of ours since the beginning. We're really grateful to be on their show and have them on our show. So check them out. It was a ton of fun.
The FSF crew are our OG podcast friends, and we love them so much. They do a phenomenal all nerdy, no dirty show. It is 100% family friendly. If you can think of a cool sci-fi actor, writer, or creator, they've probably been on FSF, so you should go check it out.
Yeah, for sure.
And you should go check us out because we're funny and we had a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And we had some real deep cuts on Star Wars jobs.
We really did. Well, you did.
I saw some Visions content in there for you. Mm-hmm. Anyway, plot recap.
Yeah, let's do it.
In honor of a fallen warrior gone too soon, I think we should start with the M plot for Marva.
Aww.
On Ferrix, Marva Andor has died. Mm-hmm. And I would like to put a pox on the houses of every screenwriter that did not give us the tragic death scene we deserved.
We got the tragic death scene of B2 Emo sitting there, the daughters of Ferrix in the house cleaning it up, Brasso watching everything. And B2 is shaking so bad because no one knows what to do with him that the coffee cup on his head shakes off. And I cried. I have cryometer 11.
Oh, no. I will say when Brasso kneels down and goes to B2 and is like, we're taking her body out. Do you want me to clear the room? The way my panties shot off my body, I've never seen a handsomer thing in my entire life. From my attractometer skyrocketed off the top.
I'm just sitting here crying, and she's like, ooh, that Brasso.
That Brasso. So Marva is such an important figure on Ferrix as a former president of the Daughters of Ferrix that she's going to get a big old funeral mm-hmm. on Rix Road. And everyone assumes that Cassian will have heard about it. So her house becomes the most watched doorstop on Ferrix.
Cinta is watching that door. Someone else named Korv is watching that door.
Well, so Cinta got a job at the cafe that is literally across from Marva's house, which, like, apparently the commercial and residential zoning on Ferrix is correct, mm-hmm. that you can have a cafe across the door from your house. But so Cinta is keeping an eye on the door. There's an Imperial officer stationed there organizing all of the imps that are keeping a watch on the house.
Cinta and this guy Korv don't know that the other one is a spy.
It's like the Spider-Man, like, not mm-hmm. even knowing to hold a gun.
Yeah, exactly.
And Deidre Miro tells the prefect guy on Ferrix, the ball gown guy.
Yeah. Prefect ball gown.
Yeah. He's like, they're going to apply for a permit. Let them. We need to have a funeral, and we need to be seated throughout the crowd to mm-hmm. keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
Because they all think Cassian's going to show up. Cyril also finds out that Cassian is supposed to show up because Lieutenant Mosk calls him from Morlana One.
Where he's working in a smelter and just has a very bad job. And he tells it in his normal, ridiculous Irish cop accent. And, like, the story makes no sense. It's actually beautifully shot. It's really cool.
It's really well done. He wakes Cyril up in the middle of the night from Edie's house. Mm-hmm. And and he's like, you gotta get to Ferrix for the funeral. So Cyril steals his mom's jewelry and takes off into the night to untarnish his reputation.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the Marva plot. We should also talk about the A plot for Andor.
So Andor and Melshi are sitting there. They're crawling up a cliff barefoot. Melshi's like, I cannot hold on. And
they're free climbing up a chalk cliff, which you live in Colorado. You know it's a bad idea.
It's terrible. Cassian's like, they're leaving. And Melshi's like, they're not leaving. You're lying to me. Tell me they're leaving again. Like
they're so cute.
They're really struggling. And they make it to a nice little lake where there are two dudes fishing.
Yeah, there's, I guess, some native Narkinafivians.
Narkinians?
Narkinians.
Mm-hmm.
They are fishing. They're not doing so hot because it turns out that the Narkina 5 prison is messing up the hydrology of Narkina 5, which we could have told you that for free.
It's a delightful scene because they're trying to steal these guys' old ship, which is an old crappy quad jumper. So they run over.
Melshi fumbles the ball so hard.
Because they run towards the ship and then they get caught by a net trap.
Yeah, the aliens kind of like look around, scratch their bellies, hit a button on a remote, and it covers them in sticky spider gloop and takes them down.
And then there's this like threatening scene where they're speaking in these ridiculous alien pirate accents, and one of them doesn't speak like galactic basic, he's like, ho ho ho. And the other one's like, ah,
they look like the cave trolls from Lord of the Rings.
Mixed with the pirates from Pirates of the Caribbean. The sea monster ones. They're ridiculous.
And there's 1,000 credits on the head of any escaped Imperial prisoners, dead or alive.
But they're like, however, we hate the Empire and it's not worth their money because they killed all the fishy fishes. So where do you boys want to go? And they're like, Niamos? Sure, why not?
So they go back to the beach where mm-hmm. Cassian got picked up. He sneaks into his old hotel room where nobody has cleaned above the bathroom sink in 2 months.
It's above the shower, but yeah.
Service is just not what it used to be, Sam. Nobody wants to work these days. And he grabs all of his credits and his gun and his family heirlooms.
And Nimix Manifesto.
And then on the most beautiful beach phone booth in Star Wars history, he calls home to Zan, mm-hmm. who runs the bodega on Ferrix. And he's like, tell Marva I'm on my way home. She would be proud of me.
I think he says, tell Marva I'm doing great. I don't need to come home. Like because the conversation they had earlier was like, you can't stay and I can't go.
Oh.
And he's like, cool, I'm out in the world. I'm having fun. I'm like actually doing all right. But then Zan is like, your mother died. He's like, I got to go back to Ferrix.
And he can hardly believe it. And then all of a sudden, he's on his own again because he and Melshi kind of like shake hands, clap shoulders, and they're like, we have to split up, double our chances. Someone needs to know what's going on Narkina 5.
Yeah, exactly.
So Cassian is looking out into the sunset, deciding what to do. And then we finish the episode with Luthen's plot.
Yeah, that's an exciting one. There's also Mon Mothma's plot.
Yeah.
Eh,
we'll talk about it later.
Luthen's plot.
Luthen pays a very spicy visit to Saw Gerrera, who in the last couple of days, because he's annoying, was like, you know what I feel like doing? Exactly what Luthen wanted me to do. Give air support to Anto Krieger for his spellhouse mission. And like typical frickin' Saw, Luthen shows up knowing that he has doomed Anto Krieger's men to die mm-hmm. so that they don't reveal that they have a mole at the ISB. And Saw is like, we're so excited to do this mission. And Luthen either has to let a second rebel cell die
mm-hmm.
or reveal to Saw that he's going to sacrifice these guys.
And that revelation freaks out Saw.
He loses his mind.
So Saw is sitting there and he's like, this means you have people on the inside everywhere.
Do you have people with me?
And Luthen, telling that this is a very spicy situation, says, yeah, it's Tubes. And Tubes runs forward and is like, it's not me. I'm super cool. And Luthen grabs Tubes' gun and points it at Saw's neck.
Holds it to his jugular. And Saw is like, oh, so you're going to take me out next? And Luthen is like, no, I'm doing this because you are a child and I'm helping you focus on the priority here.
Yes.
And I'm like, thank you, Luthen. Someone needed to take freaking Saw Gerrera in hand, and I appreciate that about you.
So Luthen reveals that if Krieger goes down, the ISB feels invincible. They feel like they're doing great, because another quick little scene here was that the ISB agents, or I guess it's Prelate Ballgown, is showing Bix a picture of Anto Krieger, and is like, is this the person who Cassian met? And we don't get to see if Bix says yes or no, but the ISB is all about chasing down Anto Krieger. And so Luthen is saying, if Krieger goes down with his 30 men plus Krieger, which you can tell he keeps saying he cares about, if they go down, the ISB feels invincible, and then we can act with impunity. Mm-hmm. But if I pull back, they're always going to be watching their back. They're going to be paranoid, like you are now, Saw Gerrera.
Mm-hmm. So Saw cools it. He agrees not to tell Krieger. They establish an uneasy balance in their relationship again. Luthen returns to the Fondor.
However,
he takes off, and Clea calls, and in code, they are determining whether Luthen is going home or somewhere else.
Or going to Ferrix to kill Cassian.
Oh, okay. That's what the conversation was.
They don't use names, and they're like, oh, but the other actors in this sale, you know, like, we need to make this sale. What about the other buyers? Yeah, the other buyers, I don't know if I should pay them a visit. And it's the implication is that Cassian is the other buyer and Luthen needs to go to him and kill him.
I did not pick up on that. Fascinating. So then as Luthen is in the air, a whole Imperial Arrestor cruiser shows up, locks him in the tractor beam, and they're going to board him for practice.
And we get to see two really cool things. One is that this Star Destroyer, it's an Arrestor class cruiser, is the original design for the Star Destroyers from Colin Cantwell way back in the day.
Maybe that's why I wrote down Star Destroyer subconsciously and then went back and checked my mm-hmm. notes and was like, oh, okay.
So it pulls his ship in, it puts him in a tractor beam, and Luthen is like, hey, Fondor droid, I need a fake transponder. Start prepping hidden countermeasures. Give us a dodgy left thruster. Make me look Alderaanian. He puts on an Alderaanian accent. And he's like, oh, sorry, I'm a one-man show. I'm sorry. I can't help you. And he's getting pulled in. And then he says, all right, this is all ready. Gun it. He starts taking off, and the captain of the Arrestor class is like, hey, it was at 2, turn it to 5, pull him in.
So he sends a barrage of air splinters behind him,
which shred the Arrestor class cruiser.
Are you kidding? It turns their tractor beam into a colander.
At which point the captain, the whole bridge of this ship starts smelling like poop as they all simultaneously are just like, what just happened? They send out their TIE fighters and this Fondor Hallcraft, which is apparently just like the Honda Odyssey of space, starts zooming around, guns down one TIE fighter and guns down another one. And then the laser beams out the side turn on.
It's like a Sith double lightsaber.
It turns into full blend mode, chops the other two, and then pretty rapidly, especially for Star Wars, the little Fondor droid is like hyperspace coordinates available, and they punch it, and they're gone.
Are you kidding me?
This is our first, well, I guess since the Eye, this is the first time we've even seen a TIE fighter in Andor, and this scene is amazing.
That scene slapped so hard. I was yelling. It was like the Clone Wars came to life.
And Luthen's like sitting there driving this thing, and he's like, you can tell he's super concentrating, but he's rocking back and forth. It's a little one-person craft. It is literally like he's doing a dogfight in a space van. It is ridiculous.
Can you imagine being the Empire and just being a big bully and you're like, yeah, we're just going to beat up on this little nerdy kid for practice. And then he takes out one TIE fighter with side missiles and then blenderifies the other two in one move and evades your tractor beam and takes out your ship and swoops off without breaking a sweat. Can you imagine? What?
Like, that dude is dead. Like, the captain of this thing is going to go back to his local agent, you know, local naval agent. And they're like, we need you to kill your entire crew and then yourself.
Can you imagine filing the report? Yeah. I would simply Sudoku myself on my desk with a pencil. With a pencil, Sam.
Yeah, that's probably what the captain of this thing has to do. So big bummer for him.
So, okay, I'm really embarrassed about this. But the coded message between Luthen and Clea, I thought was about, like, Luthen backing Cassian up. And it just was not.
Yeah, it's Cassian going to Ferrix to determine what to take this other buyer out of the equation.
Okay, so because I'm slow on the uptake, I gotta parse this a little bit. Clea calls in and is telling Luthen, yes, kill Andor, or no, let Velen Cinta kill Andor.
So Clea calls in and she says, how was your meeting with the buyer? Did they buy what you were selling?
And he's like, yeah, it was really expensive, meaning I had to betray T'Saw and his entire rebel cell that I'm killing off.
That I have an agent in the ISB.
Well, yeah, and he's killing off Krieger's men.
Yes, which is harsh. But yeah. Saw turns around and Saw's like, well, then it's war. Like, that is war. We're no longer rebel cells. Anto Krieger is now posthumously my ally.
He actually, Luthen, probably strengthened his bond with Saw's cell, which is cool.
Which is cool. But then Clea says, what about the other sale you need to make, which is the other piece of information, your other chore out there? And Luthen says, well, I guess I better go take care of it myself, and which means go to Ferrix and either kill or bring on board Cassian. And Clea's like, yeah, you got to take him out of the picture. Like, this is a very...
I thought that Clea was wanting Luthen to not do what Luthen wanted to do.
I think Clea wanted Luthen to not go to Ferrix.
Yeah.
Because she's hyper-protective of him. There's another scene in this episode where Vel shows up at Clea's shop and Clea's like, you are small baby.
You are breaking so many rules. You need to not be here.
And then we follow Vel to Mon Mothma's pad where we watch Leda in a Chandrillan fertility prayer circle.
Yeah, I want to talk about the Leda Mon plot. I just wanted to finish.
The plot recap.
I wanted to finish thinking about what Luthen's mission was, because he and Clea are diametrically opposed in their approaches to this rebellion. Mm-hmm. Clea correctly recognizes that Luthen is the linchpin of the rebellion right now.
Yeah.
So she is hyperprotective of him, which I would assume meant that Clea would want Cassian dead at all costs.
Yes.
So I'm a little confused why Clea wouldn't tell Vel when Vel comes into the shop, why are you not on Ferrix killing Cassian Andor?
Well, I think that's because the original mission called for just Cinta. Because two people, like they said that when Vel and Cinta were on Ferrix, like Cinta said two people draw too much attention, one person's fine.
Gotcha.
So that's also, Vel is way too blonde to be on Ferrix because everyone on Ferrix is like swarthy and brunette.
She does look like a Scandinavian ice princess compared to everybody else.
She does blend in the Chandrillan embassy nicely.
Oh. So. 100%. Okay, yeah, I understand why Vel left. I guess this calls back to the conversation that Luthen and Clea had, where Luthen needed convincing that Andor needed to die.
Yeah, a little bit of convincing. I feel that Clea is still living in spycraft land, and Luthen is sitting there in the Fondor killing TIE fighters. He's like, yeah, war were declared. Like, this, it's game on.
Game on like Donkey Kong.
Yeah, Luthen is, I think Luthen, now that he's killed some TIE fighters, is like, okay, it's time. I've drawn a gun, I've killed some dudes, like the war has begun, and that means that we're looking for allies rather than minimizing exposure. And Clea is still a tough cookie about that kind of thing. Like, she is very, very mean to Vel.
Let's think about what Cassian would have done So he called Zan, finds out his mom died. As you correctly pointed out, he was like, listen, mom, I'm out there in the world. I'm doing good stuff. I don't need to come home. I love you. Right. Do you think he would have gone with Melshi to go try to spread the word about Narkina 5? What do you think his next step was going
to
be?
No, because it was Melshi's idea to split up, because Melshi was sitting there deeply traumatized by the experience of not seeing other escapees.
Right.
And remember how we talked about how, like, in these great escapes where 1,000 people escape, 2 of them actually get free?
Oh, no.
And Melshi's like, if we're the only 2 who got free, we need to do something about this. So wow. Melshi's like, I'm going to go track down Saw Gerrera and get an X-Wing and blow up these facilities. Like, I'm going to figure
stuff out. Do you
think
that's what he meant?
Well, I mean, what else is he going to... Is he going to go to the Mon Mothma and say...
So Melshi is just a rando. He doesn't know any of the movers or the shakers in the rebellion. He might not even know that there's a rebellion that exists that would help him. My big question is, where could Melshi go?
Yeah,
great question. Who's going to listen? Who's going to do something?
Well, that's the first season of Melshi coming out in 2025 on Disney+.
Melshi's got charisma. I would watch more Melshi.
Actually, the reason that Melshi's character in Universe Prime first appeared in a different work.
Oh.
Yeah. And he was pulled into Andor because they're like, this is a cool dude.
Yeah, I like him.
He gets like 4 lines in Rogue One.
That's cool. Yeah. I would watch more Melshi.
Yeah.
Yeah, he and Cass have a really fun dynamic.
They do, because Melshi's got this really sad face. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like, but he also, as he was sneaking through Narkina 5 last episode, he's got the hand gestures and he's killing people and he's yelling like one way out. But he's got the sad, it's like, I'm so sorry for you. I'm so sorry.
He's tall and droopy and woeful.
Yeah.
He's Wednesday's child, full of woe. So I guess if they know that the Empire is bad, the logical conclusion is to go to people who are against the Empire. But where do you track down your local friendly rebels?
Well, on the upside, they're both hardened criminals. So
we don't know that Melshi's a criminal.
I'm pretty sure he's a criminal.
He could have been like a pickpocket.
So here's the thing. Let's say he got caught for pickpocketing, but also, he was like an assassin for hire who always got away with it. Similar to how Cassian was a tourist who got picked up and put in Narkina 5 for touristing, but was actually an intergalactic terrorist thief.
Okay, yeah, good point. Melshi did not handle a blaster in the compelling way that I imagine an assassin does. And we've seen a lot of assassins in Star Wars so far.
This is true. Okay, fair.
Yeah.
However, Melshi is the kind of guy who's running off and he's like, I'm going to get together, maybe join an underground news network, maybe like follow the threads and travel around. Because I'd imagine that, you know, Cassian's got this suitcase full of cash and he's like, Melshi, here's like 30,000 credits and a blaster. Like, go solve your issues.
Here's what is cool and just struck me. We're watching Andor season 1 after Rebels season 1, mm-hmm. which means that Ezra's message broadcast out to the entire Lothal region of the galaxy.
Yes.
So if Melshi joins an underground news network, maybe someone has heard the Lothal call.
Yeah.
And he's going to be like, okay, I got to go to Lothal and figure out who these rebels are, and then they can point me to someone who can help. What if he talks to Ahsoka?
Yeah, yeah, or Jun Sato, or Kleya.
Or
Saw, yeah.
Not Krieger.
Yeah.
Rip in advance.
Rip in advance, Krieger. So wherever he goes, he is like fully radicalized, armed and dangerous rebel.
But okay, counterpoint. If that was Cassian's idea too, when Cassian split off from Melshi, the logical conclusion for him would have been to return to Marva, who's the only confirmed rebel he knows.
And that's what he's doing.
But he wasn't going to do that.
He wasn't. I think he had experienced internal catharsis. I think Cassian had been like, Marva is right. I can't stay on Ferrix because there's too much heat there. And I am currently living in the Kleya version of the rebellion where I need to be invisible and I need to be deadly and I need to be practicing impeccable OPSEC. And now that Marv is dead and he's experiencing emotions, he's like, well, now I'm going to do the Luthen or Saw version of the rebellion where I go in guns blazing and solve problems.
Oh, no, I'm experiencing feelings.
Yeah, exactly.
I am excited to see the next phase of Cassian's hero's journey because he has broken out of the walls that not only he built around himself, but that the Empire built around him. So it doesn't feel like he's going to go on rejecting the call, but we don't know for sure that he's going to accept the call and what his adventure will look like when he finally does. It's kind of like Andor season one set up Cassian's decision to accept the call, but we're not really seeing him begin the adventure. So I'm kind of like, maybe next episode is going to launch him, like hard launch him into something.
Yeah, it's interesting. We keep coming back to this, and I'm reminded of like the really, really old antiquity stories of the Odyssey and the Iliad and Gilgamesh, because they all have like these crazy, weird backstory things going on. Like all of the Iliad is like, and then a war happened for like 20 years, and here's a bunch of cool stuff. And they were like doing things, and then you began the Odyssey, which is the aftermath. Mm-hmm. And that's where the really magical mystery stuff happens. But the
Lord of the Rings follows this too.
Yeah.
There is an entire first age of history and wars, and now everything's crumbling. And here in the Middle Age is when our journey begins.
And so Andor having like this setup to showcase all of his skills and to be like, yep, he has put all of these into practice, and he's now been tempered and forged into an instrument of rebellion.
Ooh, fun. Do you want to talk about a different instrument of rebellion in the form of a financial backer, a.k.a. I want to talk about Mon.
Yeah, so we get to see Mon Mothma just a little bit. She's just despondently watching and explaining to Vel what Leda is up to.
Leda got religion.
And it's like, I don't know if it's Chandrillan tradition, and it's hard to tell exactly what they're doing, but they're all chanting in
Leda, Leda calls it, we were practicing the chant. So, Sam, you grew up in Colorado. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Georgia. I don't know if you are familiar with this, but gals in the South kind of hit 13 and get religious.
Hmm.
And get really into like small group and Bible study and get all their friends together to do Christian religious stuff. I'm speaking about this because Christianity is one of the dominant religions.
In the American South?
In the American South.
Yeah.
It's possible that this happened in other communities that I wasn't really a part of.
Yeah.
But yeah, Leda gets all of her friends over to the Mothma dining room table, and they're practicing this kind of icky traditional chant that's all about yielding and being bound and like braided into tradition.
Yeah. And there's interesting thoughts there. One of them is that like Vel and Mon are like, wow, I did not expect this, because we're in the capital of the galaxy.
Like, they're in the cool, swanky, bourgeoisie, like progressive hub of the galaxy.
Yeah. And what does Perrin think about this? Mon Mothma's like, he's surprisingly open to the old traditions. There's a concept of like a backlash, because really, Leda has been there this whole time. She's born on Coruscant, right? She's a, well, probably, but she's not growing up on Chandrilla. So she doesn't, and Mon Mothma alludes to this. She says it's actually stronger here than it is at home.
Yeah.
And so it's like the immigrant community of Chandrillans on Coruscant has a stronger connection to the traditional way of living than anyone else does, because they're like, it's this rebound of how they grew up.
Yeah. So one of the main kind of concepts in political science and cultural studies is a pendulum swinging. Mm-hmm. And when a pendulum swings too far one way, the immediate backward swing of the pendulum is just as drastic in the other direction. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you move to Coruscant, you could be anyone, you could do anything. You need something to grab onto if you want to retain your identity. So you grab onto old traditions.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting, because Mon and Perrin did follow the Chandrilin traditions, so theoretically, Lita should have been swinging back the other way towards what Vel does, which is not tied to Chandrila at all.
But maybe she's one of those teenagers who knows what's going on by reading between the lines. Like, she knows that her parents' marriage is a sham and, like, there's really no love there. And she knows that it's probably her mom's fault because her mom is leading a double life.
Ooh.
Yeah, she doesn't know what double life her mom is leading, but she knows her mom is leading a double life because her dad is just like, here I am, like, drinking squigs, being, you know, being a cool dad. And mom is sitting there being like, I'm a bleeding heart progressive
and senator. And I'm withdrawn and repressed and upset all the time.
Yeah. And so Leda wants to be like, why do I want, what is my mom protecting? Like, this idea of Chandrila. Well, I want to live into that because I don't want to be a senator, but I want to align with what that means.
Huh.
But then the conversation continues, and Vel, having watched this prayer meeting, is like, please tell me you're not accepting proposals.
Ooh.
And Mon Mothma's like, so here's the deal.
Okay, yeah. So we get way more insight into the Mon Mothma financial situation, which I wish had been earlier. So what happened is that Mon Mothma is way more wealthy than we thought. She was funneling $100,000 a month to the rebellion out of her multiplicative family trust fund accounts.
Mm-hmm.
There were a million accounts. It was so easy. All of a sudden, she gets twigged off by one of the Chandrilin bankers back home who's like, listen, there's an audit coming. You gotta get your accounts in order. She pulls everything back into her main account,
mm-hmm.
except there's one teeny tiny obscure random account from which $400,000 is missing. So it's not that Mon has been plotting all season to get $400,000 to the rebellion. It's that $400,000 was a blip on her account.
But it's enough of a blip.
But it's enough of a blip that now she has to basically consider selling Lita for pennies.
And Vel asks, does Luthen know about this? And Mon's like, no, yeah, no.
Which, why, like, doesn't he? They just made $87 million on Aldani.
She doesn't know that, right? Like, she kind of knows that, but she can't prove that. Luthen never tells anyone anything about anything.
This is why speaking in code is such a bad idea. If someone spoke in code to me, I would be like, I'm so sorry. You're going to need to unpack every suitcase in that sentence because I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. The context is really complicated here. And it's fun because we get to see it multiple times in this episode, multiple conversations of people speaking in code.
Luthen and Clea seem to know what each other are saying, but, like, I didn't.
Yeah.
Which I guess is the point.
Yeah, that's fine.
I wonder if Mon is looking at Lita at the dining room table, enthusiastically excited about the old Chandrilin tradition. And she's thinking, like, this would be so easy because this is what Lita wants.
Mm-hmm.
But Mon knows that getting married at 14 is a really bad idea.
Or Mon is sitting there saying, I am from 10 generations of noble Mothmas, and this Skulden character is nothing but a cheap, you know, con artist. He's new rich, and I can't touch that. Like, maybe she is actually socially conservative in that regard, with regards to her own customs. And that's, like, what Lita grew up in, right? Is, like, the Chandrilin customs are super important. What my mom does is try to bring the Chandrilin customs to the whole galaxy because every single religion, because let's call that what the Chandrilin traditionalist view is.
Sure, culture.
Yeah, every single one of those has a lot of good elements.
Sure. There's a lot of stuff about morality and how you should treat other people and how you should be in the world.
And, like, formal hospitality rules mm-hmm. of, like, you must help people in need. And mm-hmm. so maybe she's like, the way I can be most Chandrilin, like my mom, is to fall into the Chandrilin customs.
Here's the thing. normally I might agree with you about Mon not wanting to sully her reputation by marrying off her daughter to this thug. But the only textual evidence that we've gotten for Mon caring about her reputation is when she says, "I have carefully cultivated an outward appearance as a gadfly, as just an annoying pest. And my record is pristine. Everything is sterling. And I use that as a weapon to be a tool for the rebellion." So my perception of Mon is that she doesn't give two hoots about her standing on Chandrila. She cares two hoots about her ability to get stuff done by flying under the radar. And this would attract controversy and make it hard for her to fly under the radar.
Perhaps.
And she loves her daughter. And this Skuldan character, we don't know who this 14 son is and what he's like, but he's an unknown quantity. And who wants to sell off their daughter to some rando oligarch's kid? He could be the Joffrey of Game of Thrones.
He absolutely could be. On the other hand, she could be like, yeah, he can come and stay with us and be raised by us, because that is like, that's how you would impress upon someone a good attitude. But then that's the Jedi problem as well, is like, hey, you're over 3 years old. We can't raise you as a Jedi because you have opinions about things.
Totally. Yeah. We even see when Ezra gets taken in by the Ghost Crew.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of stuff that is already cemented in his personality. Mm-hmm. And even having a loving, functional family around you can only temper your nature so much at that point.
Exactly.
Not that human beings are not flexible and not that we can't change our personalities, but there's some deep formative stuff that's already happened to you by the time you're 14.
Absolutely.
So if this kid is a jerk bag, then Mon is consigning Lita. This alleged youth could be a terrible youth.
Never has anyone ever been as like critical of an unnamed, unseen alien child. Like, I don't know. They're 14-year-old and they're male. That sounds sus to me.
I have a deep and abiding suspicion of any 14-year-old male. They're the youths.
I was a 14-year-old male for a whole year.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That must have been terrible.
It was 2000.
Wow. Yeah. Good thing you grew out of it.
I did. Everyone grew out of it. Everyone grew out of 2000.
That does inevitably happen.
Yeah.
You do grow out of being 14.
Yeah.
Who are you on the other side?
A 15-year-old.
Possibly worse.
Oh, man.
I would like to state one complaint.
Okay.
And it is a follow-on to my previous complaint.
About 14-year-old boys.
Well, okay, you're right. I'm complaining a lot. I'm sorry.
We don't even have like neighbors.
My complaint previously, my major complaint was about Marva not getting the beautiful, tear-jerking death scene that I felt she deserved.
Mm-hmm.
I also feel like having Marva die before doing anything for the rebellion is such a waste.
Mm-hmm.
She got this cool character arc of turning to the rebellion.
Yep.
And it was like, yeah, this old lady is going to be a rebel and do awesome stuff. And then she dies.
And then she dies.
She didn't do anything.
Not yet.
She just kicked around at a Stormgrade.
And she is getting all of Ferrix together. Because this is the way, speaking of cultural traditions, the way they do it in Ferrix is that they cremate you into a brick and put you into a wall.
That's so metal.
It's metal. It's very cool. It's very cool. And the people of Ferrix, everyone knows Marva. Everyone loves Marva. And every single funeral that they've had over the past 15 years, they've been like, no, you can't have a funeral. We're turning you down. And this one, they said yes. The entire town, the entire planet is going to be sitting there with whatever they do for funerals for Marva. She's bringing the whole planet together.
They're probably going to have the Time Wrangler do like a cool drum beat for her.
I hope so.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I have seen the next episode, and so I'm withholding spoilers, but it's going to be fun.
Okay.
Because this is another one of those Andor episodes where we're just ratcheting up tension. And we did resolve some issues previous episode, but last episode, escaping Narkina 5, one way out, screaming.
Oh, I just got goosebumps thinking about it.
Yeah. We need a break. We need a break. And that's this.
That's true.
And this is also the pinnacle starfighter fight. Like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
It was a phenomenal episode. It's funny because I think if you recut Andor, we would be able to talk about things differently. Andor kind of feels like a 12-hour braid that they just sort of sliced at 40-minute increments. And every episode has an ebb and a flow to it. Mm-hmm. But I think you could smash everything together in a video editor and slice it differently. And we would be able to talk about things at a different pace.
Yeah, for sure. But we talked about this previously of how the way you could tell this story would be with much more violence and action and special effects and cool fights and slow-mo and chases and what have you. But instead, what we get is after 11 episodes, we've had one TIE fighter chase in the eye where we watched three TIE fighters get shredded by space gravel. And then one TIE fighter chase just now. And it set the tension so high that like, oh yeah, these aren't dog fighters. These aren't professional starfighter pilots. This is an antiquities dealer / spy dealer who is going around killing TIE fighters. And that is the scariest thing anyone gets to do all day.
Mm.
And it made it so much more meaningful to me to have that tension slowly ratcheted up.
Mm-hmm. No, every episode is thrilling. Every episode has my palms sweaty.
Mm-hmm. And crying.
And crying. And laughing.
Yeah.
And being horrified about the state of Bix. Because Bix is not.
Oh, she looks so bad. She doesn't get any lines. She's sitting
there. She doesn't need any lines.
She's sitting there banging her head up against the wall. And we're just overhearing Dr. Gorst tell her about how the torture is going to work. And then they pull her into a room and show her Anto Krieger, who does turn out to be flipping huge, an ox of a man, as Saw would say.
He literally is barrel size and barrel shaped.
And just big beard, looks like someone who, you know, chews shotgun shells for breakfast. And he's like, is this the person? Is this the buyer? Because if she says, yes, Cassian met with Anto Krieger, then that loop is closed and they aren't going after Luthen.
But Bix doesn't know what they know. This is why torture is effective. Because Bix doesn't know if the Empire knows who Cassian actually met with. She might think that they're torturing her until she gives them the answer that they already know. So if she says yes to Krieger, if she says yes, Cassian met with Krieger, and they know that that's not the right person, they might just kill her.
Yeah.
And if she says no, then they're still going to be on the hunt for Luthen. She's in an impossible position.
Well, honestly, okay, this is why torture doesn't work. Because if she says yes, and they say wrong answer and kill her, then they kill her. And if she says no, then they say, okay, what is the answer? And they torture her more.
Oh. So if the torture is bad enough, you might just want to die.
That's why torture doesn't work, because people confess to everything. People are like, I killed JFK. I killed President Garfield. I killed President McKinley. Like, I did. You guys have no idea. I have socks full of dimes that I stole from the neighborhood kids. I'll confess to anything you want. Just please stop torturing me.
Actually, there's a scene in one of my very favorite novels. It's a Tamara Pierce novel, and like the protagonist is a hardened, basically medieval cop.
Mm-hmm.
And she ends up being interrogated in a scene, and she's writing in her journal after, and she's like, I started out like the best hardened criminal and gave them nothing. And by the end of the torture, I was feeding them such a pottage of half-truths and lies, I don't even remember what I said.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Yeah, torture is not useful. And it's interesting that in the media landscape of the, speaking of me being 14, that's about when TV once again started to like go into long form episodic things, because we had 24 and Person of Interest and these cool long form thrillers series. And 24 particularly was like, hey, torture porn. Like it is 2002. We are getting revenge for 9/11. Let's just torture a whole bunch of people to get them to tell us where the nuke is, where the bomb is, what's going on. And they're like, oh yeah, torture totally works. And then over the next 15 years, the American government tortured people in Abu Ghraib. And we were just like, yep, torture works. And that's not true. It doesn't do anything.
So it wasn't just Kiefer Sutherland getting tortured?
No, it was all of us, because their lawyer was Ron DeSantis. But Kiefer Sutherland was the torturer.
Oh.
He tortured people.
He was the protagonist?
Yeah.
Oh, spicy.
Yeah. The protagonist in 24 is someone who tortured people.
Oh, gross.
Because that is what things were like when I was a 14-year-old boy. Well, 15 at that point. We were moving into this realm where we were taking the knowledge we had learned from the entire Cold War, which lasted like 60 years, and then like, okay, so torture doesn't work. No matter how much you torture the KGB agent, they'll confess to anything, or they won't. You shove, you know, CIA McDude bro to Lubyanka in St. Petersburg and he'll confess to everything, but it's meaningless because he doesn't know anything, because we practice good OPSEC. And then we start fighting terrorists and we think of like, let's torture them. But that wasn't the point. The point is to make people who don't remember what things were like before 9/11 to believe that torture works.
What is OPSEC? That's the second
time. Operational security.
Okay.
That's what Clea breathes. That's what
she is very good at it.
Yes. Clea's job is OPSEC. So yeah. But this whole concept is of normalizing what these things mean. Truly crazy.
It is cool to hear your outside modern day perspective of why torture doesn't work, because I think it's another brick in the wall to be thematic of why the empire
sucks
and is terrible, but yeah, also is building their regime on an unsteady foundation. As we're in this Rebels and or era, we're talking a lot about how Tarkin's doctrine of fear only works to a point, and oppression only works to a point. And the Empire has designed a system where everybody in the galaxy has a reason that is personal to them to rise up against tyranny. Mm-hmm. So like their ship is a sieve. They are riding the ocean in a colander and they just don't know it yet.
Yeah, and I think the reason for that is that the Tarkin Doctrine is a means to an end for Palpatine and Vader. There is a scene, which will happen in 5 years in universe, where a very famous character in Empire Strikes Back is tortured. And he gets done with torturing, and he's just like, they didn't even ask me any questions.
Whoa.
Because that wasn't the point.
The point was just to torture someone?
The point was to cause pain, because it echoes throughout the Force, and that the Force users will come and see it. This is why Vader strolled through the streets dragging someone from breakfast before snapping their neck in Kenobi.
To make himself stronger through the dark side of the Force?
To make Obi-Wan see him and be drawn to him. They're snuffing out the light. And Tarkin's like, I literally do not use the Force. I am an old skinny man. Like, I don't even use a gun anymore. And so how do I use this evil power? And Palpatine and Vader are like, yeah, just like nuke whatever. We don't care. Just like blow up cities. Cause pain. Because we do that with an intent. You do it to give us power.
Well, and to make the light side of the Force harder to access for any other lingering Force users out there, right? Whenever Yoda is meditating and sensing the darkness of the Force, it disempowers him.
Yeah. Ooh. And so now they're flooding the zone with pain, with agony. They're doing the 40 atrocities per minute that Nemec talks about to disassociate the good.
It's like they're fritzing the signal.
Yeah, exactly. They're blocking good people from seeing that there is a good path forward.
So that's why hope is the weapon of the rebellion.
Exactly.
Because it purifies and strengthens the light side of the Force.
Yep.
Ooh.
And that's why Saw Gerrera is sitting there, and once he realizes he's the one actually in control of this situation, because Luthen's like, you can call him, you can join him, I can't stop you, you can kill me, but now I've let you in on the secret, and it is up to you whether you are a rebel cell or whether you are part, or you're fighting a war. Because when you are fighting a war, you do have to sacrifice people in the hope that you're playing the longer game.
My whole body's one goosebump. I never really got it. I was like, yeah, hope is important. You gotta inspire people to the cause. I had not put the pieces together between the foot soldiers of the rebellion, which is like people on Lothal, and the ghost crew, and their ripple effect into the force, and how that can be a weapon for people like Kenobi, who are out there who can actually use the force.
Well, think about those fishermen. Okay. First of all, they're great. They look like Vogons from Hitchhiker's Guide. They're just like 8 feet of rubber monster.
They and are so great.
One of them has a knife for a hand. It's like, oh, ho, ho. But they're sitting there and they're like, yeah, the Empire sucks.
F the Empire. Go wherever you want.
Go. We'll give you a ride. Like, we don't care. Because they've already become, they've already recognized. Because they have to live there. Now the fact that there are escapees, now that there is a moment. Think about the fruit seller from the guy.
The farmer in Rebels season
one. Yeah, the farmer in Rebels season one who they rescue from his farm.
The Empire's going to burn down his farm because he didn't sell the land to them.
And then they're going to drive him off to kill him. And then Ezra shows up and rescues him. What happens to that farmer? He tells his friends. Ooh. There are people out there. And it's spreading like wildfire. All they need to do is get the message out. But in order to do that, they need to survive and they need to make tactical sacrifices. So while Melshi is going off sending the message, Saw is actually fighting the war. Saw's not the person you want to send messages. Saw's not the person who would send a message of hope. Saw's the blunt instrument who brings X-Wings.
He's just a hammer.
And when you bring X-Wings to a fight, that fight, like, you need a Star Destroyer to stop X-Wings. Wow. So, yeah.
So every person who becomes a Melshi or a Saw or the farmer on Lothal does, in a way, become a weapon for the light side of the Force.
Yes, because rebellions are built on hope.
Oh, stop. I'm going to cry. I'm tearing up a little bit.
Yeah.
It feels like this is the puzzle piece that never really made sense to me, and it just kind of snicked into place. Wow. Star Wars is so good.
And Andor particularly. Such a treat to watch something that's so well paced and plotted and
beautiful.
Yeah, this is just damn fine TV.
It's just like eating the best dessert. But we get to do it every week.
We do.
I love Andor.
On that note, I think it's time to do some Baywatch.
To talk about everybody else that we love.
And choose a favorite.
Yes.
All right.
Sam, who's your bae?
Oh, it's Luthen.
Oh, wow. Ooh, wait, tell me why.
Okay. First of all, highest kill count to the episode. Second of all, which always counts. Second of all, that great conversation he had with Clea as he's wandering throughout the Fondor being like, yes, this other buyer, what am I going to do? But most importantly, he shows up and he shows more of himself to Saw in order to get Saw on board. In the last two conversations he's had with Saw Gerrera, I think he's gotten Saw to do something pretty dang critical for the rebellion.
Which is like pull together and become part of the rebellion?
Yeah. Because he has built up trust. He has said, here are my goals. Here's the price of admission. You need to work with other rebels. And Saw's like, hell, I'll honestly, you've convinced me, I'll do that now. And then Saw says, also, you need to know that I have agents everywhere. That is how I keep my strength. You need to chill out about me having agents everywhere because that's important. I need you to trust me. And Saw agrees to that.
Mm.
And we've known Saw Gerrera for a long time.
Since he was a foolish youth. And now he's just a foolish man who's aged well beyond his years.
The funny thing is that Saw basically is instantiated in reverse. In the Prime universe, he wasn't introduced until Rogue One. And then in internal chronology, he's then later in Clone Wars and Bad Batch and now Andor. And he's like, he's all over, but he is an important character and Luthen has him. But he does it in this way of continuously like being open and being unarmed and being whatever, and then holding a gun to his neck. And that shows Saw that he speaks Saw's language. He speaks Saw's language. He speaks Clive's language. He speaks Mon Mothma's language.
He spoke Lonnie's language last episode. Luthen knows how to get people to do what he wants.
And he does that through saying, this isn't what like I want. I wrote a cause and then fully subscribed to it and subsumed myself into it. And here's how it works. And if you want to be part of it, you got to listen to me or Clea, who is me. Me and Clea are the same person in two bodies. We are as one. And so you need to be on board with this. And he gets people to do that.
So you know what is so cool? In political science, the fundamental study is the study of power.
Mm.
And what is power? Power is the ability to get people to do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And there is hard power where you force them, and there's soft power where you manipulate them. And Luthen can do it all.
Mm-hmm.
He can apply any level of negotiation or coaxing or brute strength and telling you that you're terrible and your life's going to be terrible and you're going to do it with a smile and you do what he wants. He is the most powerful character, or at least one of the most powerful characters on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think he is the most powerful character on the show because, yeah, I mean, who else has that type of power? Partagaz? Yularen?
The Empire has a form of power, but their power it has people squirting out underneath their feet because mm-hmm. people don't want to do what they want them to do.
Yeah.
So actually they're disempowered.
Yeah, exactly.
And Luthen is not that.
No. Luthen is a leader. He leads people. They follow him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I'm choosing him. I've chosen him a bunch. I'm sitting here at the end, approaching the end of Baywatch for Andor season one. I'm like, man, I chose Kino a lot. I chose Luthen a bunch.
Well, you may have done that. I've chosen Brasso a lot, and I'm choosing him again this episode. But I have receipts. I have reasons.
He's in his scene, yeah.
He is in a scene.
It's not like that time you chose Padme when we were watching Bad Batch or something.
She deserved it. I know she wasn't in the episode, but she raised Leia so good.
Yeah, it was in
Kenobi. She imparted her genetic material into Leia so good.
Okay. So now that we've established some of the rules for Baywatch, which is that there are no rules.
There are none. The rules for Baywatch are vibes.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, I need to preface this by just saying I've never seen a more humanizing shot of a droid than when we're watching B2's eye in Marva's house mm-hmm. as he is grieving the death of his mom.
Yeah.
His gal.
Yeah. Who he was probably with for like 40 years.
His rotten soldier, his sweet cheese. But then I've never seen anyone treat a droid in Star Wars like a real person than when Brasso does it. Because there's people like Omega who loves Gonki.
Yeah.
But Omega doesn't really treat Gonki as someone with opinions on things that she can get a response to.
Or going way, way back to the R2 captured arc in the Clone Wars when we actually have a really good discourse on why Anakin keeps equivocating back and forth between like owning R2 and R2 being his friend and R2 being like a very valuable soldier. He never right. really lands on what that is.
It's messy because R2 is valuable and useful to Anakin and Ahsoka. So Ahsoka loves R2 as well, but she doesn't, I mean, he's so scrappy and resilient that you don't have to be nice to him.
Mm-hmm.
But B2 doesn't have a purpose to Marva, and he doesn't have a purpose in the show. So he's just a little kid, really. And Brasso treats him just like a person.
He's like a very loyal dog who talks.
Exactly.
And he's like, oh, well, what? I want to stay here until they move her. And then he's like, oh, can you stay with me tonight?
Oh, and Brasso's like, yeah, I know I'm 3 miles away from work, farther than I would be, and I gotta be there early, and I don't want to stay in this dead lady's frigid house, but I will for you.
Poor B2 is like, I'm charging. And Brasso's like, you've been charging all day.
Oh.
Poor little depressed droid.
Well, and then Brasso's like, okay, I'll stay. And B2's like, okay, I'm done charging. Yeah. Let's hang out. And just, I think that speaks volumes about Brasso's character without him saying much at all.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful characterization.
It is nice. I love it. I love that Brasso has these hidden depths, but also speaking of who is a rebel, it's Brasso. Because he, like, when the cops show up, he's like, I'm gonna puncture their tires. Like, I'm gonna be gone. I'm gonna be out of here.
And when they're running after Bix, he's like, I'm gonna fumble my way. I'm just a big clumsy guy.
And it's something he truly believes in, but it's not like he believes in it for a cause. He just has a sense of justice.
Well, and he does it so well. He's the only character on the show that really never got caught.
Yeah.
And he's done a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, he's a good man. It's handsome man behavior. I just, So I got a big old crush on Brasso.
Well, there you go.
Good Baywatch.
Tougher to have crushes on the females in this show.
It's also harrowing for them.
It is. And like, yeah, none of them are without deep structural flaws.
Brasso is also the only one on the show having anything approaching a good time.
Yeah, you know, he is like the least traumatized person on all of Andor.
I love that for him.
Good job, Brasso.
You go, Brasso.
All right. Well, what are we doing next week and where can you find us?
We are finishing Andor Season 1. We are watching Season 1, Episode 12, Rick's Road, which all of a sudden, I know in the beginning of Andor, that's where Cassian's dad was hanged. And I was like, oh, the last episode is named Rick's Road. That's so ominous. And I'm like, oh, that's just kind of sad. It's just going to be Marva's funeral.
Mm-hmm. Just going to be Marva's funeral.
Sam has a little twinkle in his eye. There are twists and turns ahead of us, I foresee.
Yes, you are very wise, and I'm proud of you.
Thank you. I accept. In the meantime, if you want more Growing Up Skywalker, you can find us on all the social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Threads. We have also finished the Tartakovsky Clone Wars on Patreon.
Whoop, whoop.
So if you want more weekly bonus audio content and you're interested in hearing our detailed recaps of Visions Season 1, this is a great time to sign up for the Patreon. Monthly memberships start at just $3 a month. So for less than a latte in Denver, you can get access to about 2 or 3 hours of extra content a month.
Honestly, that's less than the price of a black coffee in Denver, so.
Inflation these days.
We should raise our prices. So get in now.
Get in now before it becomes $5 a month. Who should we send this episode to?
Send this episode to someone who is trustworthy.
Oh, I love that.
And someone who's blowing up TIE fighters in their Honda Odyssey.
Especially that. I'll send it to Harris Adilla.
There you go.
And we'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Bye-bye.